On Thursday, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt finally made a decision in the case of death row inmate Julius Jones.
Just 4 hours before Julius Jones was set to be executed, Governor Kevin Stitt announced he was taking the inmate off death row.
Governor Stitt's decision spared Julius's life. And announcing the decision just a few hours before the scheduled execution meant that Jones was forced to endure hours of Oklahoma's execution protocol. He was given an inexpensive last meal. He was strip searched. All calls and visits were ended. He was moved to a room just feet away from the execution chamber.
The governor took quite a while to render his decision.
Here on The Takeaway, we talked with Reverend C.C. Jones Davis, one of the advocates who's been leading the effort to spare Julius's life.
We didn't hear from the governor until 3 hours prior to the execution. And that was a very, very grueling 48 hours. While we're grateful for the outcome, the governor, it was cruel of him to take as long as he did. The anguish that Julius's family went through for the last 48 hours, I would not wish on any human being on the face of the earth. And it was cruel. It was cruel.
Perhaps Stitt was still making up his mind. Perhaps this was a psychological ploy meant to evoke gratitude despite the fact that Stitt's halt of the execution came with a caveat. Julius Jones must now serve life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Julius Jones deserved better than this. Julius deserved for the governor to accept the recommendation of his pardon and parole board that gave him the same recommendation twice, to grant Julius a commutation of life with the possibility of parole. He gave him life without parole. Julius doesn't deserve to spend the rest of his life in prison because Julius is an innocent man.
Still, where there is life, there is hope. And Julius Jones remains alive, if not free. Then, just about 24 hours later, a Wisconsin jury returned a verdict in the murder trial of Kyle Rittenhouse.
A jury in Wisconsin today found the 18-year-old from Illinois not guilty on all charges. Rittenhouse shot and killed two protesters and wounded a third in August of 2020.
Not guilty on all five charges, including first-degree reckless homicide and first-degree intentional homicide. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we begin today's episode of The Takeaway with a question. What is justice? And do we have a legal system capable of delivering it? Joining me now is Paul Butler, the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University Law Center and a legal analyst on MSNBC. He's also the author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Melissa. It's great to be back on The Takeaway.
You know, we just talked last week, but I really wanted to speak with you again, given these two outcomes. Can we start with Julius Jones? Are there any more pathways for Jones, any additional legal remedies, given the governor's decision that he must now serve life without the possibility of parole?
Under the law, Mr. Jones has little hope, unfortunately. In theory, he could bring a case in federal court, what's called a habeas corpus proceeding, but the Supreme Court has made it very difficult for people on death row to win those claims. As you noted, the Oklahoma State Board of Clemency recommended that Mr. Jones receive life with the possibility of parole, and the governor rejected it. The power of clemency is a prerogative that the governor has. It comes from the divine right of kings in English law, and this governor has exercised it in the same kind of random and capricious way a king might. The result is that Mr. Jones is an innocent man who was on death row for 20 years. Now he's an innocent man who is sentenced to life without parole. All that means is that he won't die in Oklahoma's execution chamber. He will just die in Oklahoma State Prison.
When you talk about a sense of capriciousness or injustice, it's clear many people feel similarly about the Rittenhouse verdict. In this case, the assailant, someone who we know committed the killings, but is understood by the law now as having not committed a crime in the context of those killings. Can you help us again to understand the legal reasons, even if not the justice reasons, that this happened?
The verdict does not mean that the jurors bought the Boy Scout image of Rittenhouse that the defense presented, that he was just a medic there to render aid to anybody who was injured at this Black Lives Matter protest. The verdict means that the jury had reasonable doubt that Mr. Rittenhouse was guilty. They weren't 95% certain, but I can't imagine they're happy, these jurors who actually live in Kenosha, about an immature and reckless 17-year-old bringing a semi-assault rifle to patrol their streets. And the jurors may be troubled that other people who want to take the law in their own hands may view the verdict as an invitation.
Now, when you sort of talk about it in that way, you know, 17 years old with this, you know, kind of assault style rifle. Now, this was a decision. The judge made a decision to dismiss the gun possession charge. And I know that there were some who thought that this was potentially strategic on the part of, you know, ensuring that, like, if they couldn't go for anything else, maybe they'd go for that, but that would be a kind of a smaller charge. And that it had something to do with the actual length of the barrel of the gun, that young people are allowed to have, for example, the you know, rifles if they're going to, you know, go hunting, for example. I'm just wondering about that gun possession charge and if it maybe indicates we need some reform on that set of, on those sets of laws.
So it seems like the law in Wisconsin was just poorly written, and the lawmakers might actually have intended to outlaw Mr. Rittenhouse possessing the gun that he had, but the law just didn't capture what their intent was. That was a relatively minor charge, given that Mr. Rittenhouse was also charged with intentionally killing two people and blowing the arm off of another person. You know, this case happened during a Black Lives Matter protest about the shooting of a Black man. There were a number of counter-protesters. The scene was chaotic and violent, but as the prosecutor said in his closing argument, the only person who killed anyone was Kyle Rittenhouse.
I'm interested in this question of justice versus law. So it seems that as a matter of simply the law, the jury did not do the wrong thing. I mean, they could have made a different choice, but that there is a reading that makes sense for this verdict. But I think for many, including the families of the victims who were killed, this doesn't seem like a just outcome. How do we square justice with legal outcomes?
Criminal trials are poor instruments of social change. So if we look at the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial, he is being brought to justice for killing, for murdering George Floyd, but that's different from reforming the police. And so I understand the concerns. If, for example, Julius Jones had Kyle Rittenhouse's kind of money for a defense fund, Mr. Jones probably would not have been found guilty. There are lots of concerns about the role of anti-Black bias, white privilege, and money in our criminal legal system. And in fact, Kyle Rittenhouse beat his case because he put on the best defense that money can buy. He had a $2 million legal defense fund that allowed his lawyers before the trial to stage these two separate practice jury trials, one in which Rittenhouse took the stand and one in which he didn't. And the fake jurors responded positively to the trial where he took the stand, and that's why he took the stand at the real trial, which is probably the most important reason why he walked. And it's really important to understand, Melissa, that Rittenhouse got all this money because he was had a legal defense fund that was cheer-led by people like Donald Trump and Matt Gaetz.
You know, at this point, I think, you know, we've talked a great deal about race in the American legal system, but this point about resources feels to me so critical and maybe under-discussed. You know, even as you say the words, you know, legal defense fund, I recognize it's a very different kind of legal defense fund, but, you know, just thinking about the transition and power happening at the NAACP legal defense fund as the extraordinary Sherrilyn Ifill steps aside and her deputy, the extraordinary Janae Nelson, takes over in that role. I'm wondering if there's a way to think about how to make resources more equitable. So in the same way that LDF brought resources to the civil rights fight, is there a way to maybe think about this, about maybe bringing more resources to Gideon's Army, to public defenders, or in some way beginning to try to level that resource playing field?
It certainly would advance equal justice under the law if every accused person had the same kinds of resources that Rittenhouse had. At the same time, we can't discount the power of his whiteness. It's impossible to imagine the right embracing the cause of a young Black man who bought a semi-automatic rifle to let's say, a Stop the Steal rally and ended up killing two people and blowing the arm off of another. So Rittenhouse, for his supporters, the reason he got all this money is because he's white. His whiteness is a crucial part of his appeal.
As you look out on the sort of framework of vigilantism in the post-Rittenhouse moment, should we be concerned about more Kyle Rittenhouses?
Whether he deserves it or wants it, Rittenhouse is now the poster child for reactionary white men who want to take the law in their own hands, who want to bring assault weapons to Black Lives Matter protests, and who think that violence is a legitimate form of political discourse. This verdict makes every American less safe.
Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown University and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Thank you for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure, Melissa.
On Friday, House Democrats finally came together to pass the $2 trillion Build Back Better bill. It's legislation intended to improve the social safety net in the U.S. Now, about $19 billion in the act will be directed towards public health spending. And of that, hundreds of millions will be spent training and supporting nurses. Now, you've probably heard headlines sounding a bit like this.
Tonight, we look at how the shortage of nurses is affecting healthcare workers and hospitals.
There is a nursing shortage, not only here at the hospitals in Texas, but also in Louisiana.
This devastating nursing shortage that we're experiencing here in the U.S.
We have seen a national shortage of medical professionals, specifically nurses.
The on-again, off-again nursing shortage is on again, and it's not slowing down anytime soon.
During the pandemic, many hospitals say they've struggled to find enough nurses to continue typical day-to-day operations. And this is particularly true of hospitals in rural areas. But organizations that represent nurses say that how hospitals are framing this story is not entirely accurate.
I've been a nurse for over 46 years, and there's been a huge change since I first started working.
That's Jean Ross, president of National Nurses United, the largest organization of registered nurses in the U.S.
You can see that not just during this the time of pandemic, two employers cry that there aren't enough staff. They have said that every time they themselves have engineered a shortage. So in other words, their bottom line is the most important thing to them. Therefore, if they don't want to pay for enough of us to work, they don't.
I spoke with Jean to find out more about why nurses say there's more to this crisis than just the stress of COVID-19.
We have been I would say, harping on this for decades now before the pandemic. The pandemic has shown many, many things to us in this country, obviously, and it's highlighted this for people who didn't understand what we were going through at the bedside. So there are things, I guess you could point to California as an example. We have been trying for some time and will continue to try to get federally mandated staffing ratios, saying every registered nurse must not, in this setting, ER, med-surg, ICU, have any more than this number of patients. She can have fewer, but no more. We've been trying to get that. California is the only state that's had it for a number of years now. And all of the horror stories about, oh my goodness, we won't have enough nurses. Where will they come from? There's already a shortage. Well, lo and behold, what we said would happen did. Nurses came out of the woodwork. Nurses who hadn't worked in months, nurses who hadn't worked in years, because the conditions were such that they could do their job without fear of harming someone or themselves, because they had adequate staffing. So we know that it works. It's just a lack of willingness on the employer's part.
How is this different in rural areas versus in big cities? Or is it different?
It is very different. You should talk to a rural nurse sometime about I don't want to say jack of all trades, master of none, but in those smaller community hospitals, you do a lot of different things. So you would find maybe not a specific labor and delivery department, the nurse who works ER runs up when a woman comes in labor, that kind of thing. They're all experienced. They're very good at it. We all use a lot of critical thinking, or we wouldn't be able to continue to do what we do. But in those smaller communities, because of this push for only wanting services that make money, you start closing down facilities. And in larger facilities, you would close down certain departments that don't make you money, as I mentioned, labor and delivery. So women are having to travel farther and farther and farther away to deliver, if they choose to deliver in a hospital, which most women still do. And people who need emergency care have to travel farther away. You will find doctors and nurses leaving those rural communities because they can't do their job with the conditions that they're placed under. And we are one of the few groups, I say, that get out in mass and say, don't you dare close that community hospital. Sometimes we've been successful, sometimes not. But it's generally smaller communities, rural communities, and areas in larger cities where there are a lot of people of color. They just don't want to leave them open.
How then, given that we're 2 years into the pandemic, I guess it seems to me that new incentives would have emerged, right? So just as we've seen in minimum wage roles in food service, we have seen, sort of rising wages as a result of COVID-19 because, you know, fewer people are willing to work in these kinds of circumstances. I'm wondering, you know, if wages have gone up or the capacity to negotiate these working conditions for nurses.
Well, hospitals, employers are no different than other employers. They're very anti-union. And so we continue to organize, and we've been very successful, but it's tough. It's very, very tough. They scare employees off from organizing, and nurses are no exception to that. But I would say, if you look at the rising wages, et cetera, that have come from workers in this country right now saying, no more, I won't do this, even though wages are going up, it's very slow. They are very recalcitrant. Look at the John Deere people. They had to go on strike to get decent wages and decent pension benefits, decent health care benefits. Still a huge thing, even with the Affordable Care Act. So yes, things are changing slowly, but we're still fighting to organize, to get the things that we need. For example, PPE. Remember, all you could hear about at the beginning of the pandemic was PPE, people who never knew what PPE was, personal protective equipment. We've been fighting for those things for years. And it isn't until it's put in the public eye that they show any signs of having any shame whatsoever. But even that didn't do it. They put us in the middle of a perfect storm. We started from behind. That didn't need to be. And unfortunately, even with the pandemic, we do not see signs of them changing their minds.
thank you so much to Jean Ross, president of the National Nurses United, the largest organization of registered nurses in the U.S. So appreciate your time today.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having us on.
So we also asked our nurses out there in our listening community, how has your job been impacted by nearly 2 years of COVID-19?
Hi, my name is Thais. I'm calling from Elizabeth, New Jersey. I'm a registered nurse here in Northern New Jersey. I worked as an assisted living facility. Nursing has changed and I have switched from primary care to preventive care. And now I'm an infection prevention specialist and working on my master's in public health and soon to be an epidemiologist. So I just want you to know that our healthcare workers are out there doing everything we can so we can advocate and educate.
Hi, this is Cammie George. I live in Troutman, North Carolina. I am an operating room nurse. The biggest problem that I see right now is short staffing, which has remained and actually gotten worse because many nurses have left the profession, and inadequate pay and benefits, which is hard to swallow when most CEOs still make very high salaries with many perks.
Hi, my name is Shelley from North Andover, Mass. I work on a second shift medical surgical floor of an inner city hospital that became the COVID unit during the second surge in Massachusetts. All of us are just feeling the fire of moral injury, like that feeling that you can't do enough to serve your patients to the standards they deserve and really require. Basically, the staff-to-patient ratios have been blown out the door. We really just have a tremendous problem.
Hi, my name is Danielle Landers. I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri. I'm actually a current BSN, Bachelor's of Science degree nursing student. The way that we have been impacted as nursing students is our clinicals have been severely impacted. We have limited sites, of course, that we can go to for our clinical portion of our education. They limit the number of students at each site, and some sites have actually stopped taking students as a result. So it's really been difficult, and our staff and faculty at Methodist College, I'm sure in other nursing schools as well across the country, have had to get really creative as far as clinical sites is concerned. So it's really put a strain not just on the nursing profession, but as well on those of us that are trying to become nurses.
All right, everybody. Thanks for your calls. And according to our last guest, Jean Ross, who's president of National Nurses United, this crisis is exacerbated by the cost-cutting decisions of hospital administrators. So we wanted to find out more about the factors at play when hospital staff nurses and create budgets. Here with me now is Leo Felix Jurado, who is professor and chairperson at William Patterson University Department of Nursing. Professor Jurado, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So do hospitals, in fact, tend to hire fewer nurses per shifts in order to maximize profits?
I would say that's probably more of looking at the entire budget in terms of how much will they be able to sustain their facilities and operation of the hospital. So they look at patient acuity systems and to see how many nurses they need.
Now, I know you're based in New Jersey. How much do nursing hiring practices differ state to state?
There's a lot of variations from state to state, from urban to rural or semi-urban. So there are different variations. At the same time, there are some legislation from state to state in terms of what would be the staffing level would be for every single hospital.
So one of the things Jean suggested was that there should be a federal, a federally mandated, like patient to nurse sort of staffing procedure. Would that be sufficient to move this crisis, to kind of move us beyond this crisis in nursing?
It may or it may not be. I mean, there are a positive and negative aspect of mandated patient federal mandated number of patients per nurse. Sometimes, like in California right now, it is legislated that there is a number of patients per nurse. But as well, in other places, they would look at patient acuity because you could have one patient, but that patient is extremely acute. You cannot take care of the rest of your patients. Say, for example, you have five patients at the moment because that's a mandated number of patients you should have as a nurse. And one of them is really extremely acute. What happened with the four? So I think there should be recommendations, but not necessarily fully mandated federal law in terms of number of patients per nurse. Again, because it should be based on patient acuity.
When you talk about acuity, I'm wondering how COVID may have changed nursing staffing positions.
COVID basically changed the landscape of care in America. Aside from the nurses getting sick during COVID time, the height of pandemic, at the same time, many nurses were sick, so there were not enough nurses to take care of patients, especially when there was understaffing in the first place.
Professor, I want you to take a listen to one of our callers this weekend.
My name is Barbie, and I am a nurse in Alaska. For the past 10 years, I've worked in the emergency room. The stress, anxiety, and emotional mental toll of this pandemic has devastated the nursing field. I watched so many of my coworkers leave the ER for different departments or their nursing careers completely. The saddest aspect for me has been the lack of support and resistance to the evidence-based science to stop the spread of COVID-19 and in this nightmare that we've all been living in.
And I'm wondering about that. When you say COVID changed the whole landscape, in changing the landscape, were nurses and hospitals set in opposition to each other?
I would not say that, because I'm also working at a hospital. The thing is, when the hospital administrators' hands are tied because of limited budget as a result of many different factors, it could be as a result of lack of support from state government or federal government, especially if this is a state-funded hospital. So there are many, many factors that come into play in terms of the revenues that are not enough. At the same time, expensive payment for agency staffing as a result of nursing shortage. So that I would say the majority of administrators should really understand, they do understand the situation, but sometimes their hands are tied up in terms of they don't have anything to give. Again, especially if the facility is supported by the state or federal government. And that's why there are hospitals that are closing as a result, because they don't have funding. They feel so empathetic for nurses, because nurses basically drive the hospitals. They're the ones making the hospitals work day in, day out, 24/7. Nurses work so, so very hard, and people don't understand that sometimes nurses don't even have the time to take a break, to go to the bathroom or to eat. And working 8 to 12 hour shifts is completely difficult for them.
As you talk about the way that administrators' hands may be tied by budgetary constraints, I'm wondering if the Build Back Better Act and the resources that are allocated there could make a difference, untie some of those hands.
It may help. Definitely may help. Definitely the federal government really need to look into investing more to hospitals, particularly assisting in terms of funding for payment for nurses. Otherwise, they need to value the time for nurses. Otherwise, the shortage will go worse. I mean, right now it is projected that we will have at least 1.2 million shortage in 2030. And the only way we could assist that is to help universities of nursing produce nurses by paying faculty. Faculty of nursing are not properly paid, so that there's not enough faculty to teach nurses. So that if there's not enough faculty to teach nurses, there's not enough nurses to go work at these hospitals. So you got to look at the source. The universities really have to look at how they could invest in teaching faculty, because payment for faculty is less than working at the hospital. So that is a different treatment right there in terms of nursing faculty.
That's such a good and interesting point that I don't think we always hear. We hear about the student loan debt, but not always the faculty side. There must be someone there to teach those classes. We have very little time, but what is the future of nursing based on what you see?
Unless this nursing shortage is addressed as soon as possible, paying faculty, paying staff nurses, we will have a big issue in healthcare. We will have a crisis in healthcare where there's not enough nurses to take care of patients.
Leo Felix Jurado is professor and chairperson at the William Patterson University Department of Nursing. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
For having me.
The year is 2071. The Earth is largely uninhabitable. And a crew of bounty hunters is moving through space on a ship called Bebop.
I think it's time to blow this scene. Get everybody in the stuff together. Okay, 3, 2, 1, let's jam.
This is the cult classic anime series Cowboy Bebop. Part science fiction, part neo-noir, with a splash of slapstick comedy, the series follows a ragtag group of bounty hunters called Cowboys as they track down fugitives across space in a dystopian future.
3 days ago, there was a big shootout between his group and a rival syndicate. He killed his own guys, then took off like the wind. Word is he's hiding out with some sweet thing in Tijuana.
TJ? That place is for small fries.
Yeah, well, this small fry is worth $2.5 million.
Having originally debuted in the late 90s, the wildly popular anime series is now getting the live-action treatment, thanks to Netflix. The series, also called Cowboy Bebop, debuted on Friday and stars John Cho as the lead, Spike Spiegel.
Who are you?
Just a humble bounty hunter, ma'am.
Spike's fellow bounty hunters, Jet Black and Faye Valentine, are played by Mustafa Shakir and Daniela Panetta.
100,000.
Yeah. Barely covers fuel. Never mind food.
I thought you said this bounty was gonna go up.
Well, it did. Tanaka's worth 1.5 million. We got charged for half the casino floating out into space.
Hey, it's not our fault somebody brought a disruptor to a robbery.
Adapting animated stories like Cowboy Bebop into live action is no easy task. Anime especially, since it has a pretty unique visual and storytelling style that doesn't always translate well with live actors. That's according to Shirley Lee, staff writer covering culture for The Atlantic. I recently spoke with Shirley and with Jeff Yang, cultural critic and co-author of the forthcoming book, Rise, a pop history of Asian America from the 90s to now, about the new live-action Cowboy Bebop series.
Cowboy Bebop is cited perhaps more frequently by people of a certain generation as kind of their on-ramp to anime, their real first taste of Japanese animation, and the thing that addicted them to the medium, to the genre, right? It is an almost impossible to describe sort of amalgam of different genres, sci-fi, Western, neo-noir, and slapstick comedy. And it has some indelible characters. It is funny and dark and really kind of deeply layered and emotional. And it's a cult classic.
Okay, so that language that you use about how it is funny but also dark, it's incredibly like sexually frank in certain spaces. Mm. Shirley, it always feels to me like part of what makes those things work together in the context of anime is that it's in fact animated. So I'm kind of wondering about how a live action adaptation of that can work.
Well, often it doesn't work. It is a risky and really hard endeavor to transform anime into live action. I mean, anime, first of all, is inherently hard to adapt because it has such a precise visual style. I think anyone who has watched any series about a magical girl or a heroic little boy will notice how super expressive their facial, you know, characteristics are. The character designs are often really kinetic. That's not something you can really translate to live action. You have these realistic and lush backgrounds, sure, but they contrast with this again, this seamless expressiveness of these characters. And so I think when you adapt it into live action, you can mimic the aesthetics. You know, think of the Wachowskis, for instance. But the storytelling of anime, as Jeff mentioned, is different. Cowboy Bebop is especially different because it's about adults living out adulthood, and you have a lot of ambiguity and these self-contained conflicts instead of one overarching conflict that's driven by, you know, a good set of characters versus a bad set of characters. You know, you're seeing characters cook and take baths and trim their bonsai trees and looking out the window, and there's this feeling of melancholy and mystery that I don't think live action can translate really well. And it's just really hard and it's risky to do.
One might think that it would be easy because anime is meant to sort of give us these strong signals for what like an emotional moment is, but that stylized aspect of it does seem hard to then translate back into the live action. I'm wondering, Jeff, what you think is gained and what you think may be lost in that translation. And then we want to get into a few other things, but I'm just interested in sort of what we lose, but also maybe what we gain by going to live action.
So I've never really been somebody who has this sort of orthodoxy, this deep and abiding religious, sort of dogmatic principle on keeping interpretation of a work authentic to the original. I think that canon exists to be improvised on, like jazz, which of course is one of the biggest reasons, I think, the soundtrack, the music, that informs Cowboy Bebop's incredible popularity. If you're going to make something new, you want to make something different and not just something that reiterates what's on already existing in two dimensions. That said, I think that in some ways, the challenge of adaptation of anime is that anime just is told in a storytelling style that defies what we expect in many cases in Western storytelling. Mm. It doesn't have the same kind of beats or story arc. It doesn't have the kinds of conclusions for characters that we expect. And as a result, sometimes it can be very just discordant and jarring to people who are consuming this stuff for the first time in live action without knowing what the antecedents are, right? And for people who've actually seen the original, you have that anxiety of influence, that constant comparison. I mean, we saw that at the very beginning when people started just showing off costumes and casting and the embedded fan base for Cowboy Bebop just exploding in fan rage, right? So I guess what I would say is you always gain something. It may not be something good, but you know, you're seeing something new when you do an adaptation. I think when you lose, when you go from 2D to 3D though, is you lose in some ways that perspective of suspension of disbelief that we automatically bring to animated characters. We give, I think, a little bit more leeway, more elasticity to how stories are told in animated media than in live action, and certainly here in the West. And as a result, I think you're always going to have some disappointment.
So I love this language of the interpretive aspects and the right to interpret, any work of art, right? And to create something new in this decision to create, that it's not, in fact, just translation, right? That maybe translation is the wrong way to think about it altogether, but instead it's a reading and a retelling in, with all of the newness or difference that retelling might bring. But Jeff, your point about people already having a set of expectations, especially if this was their on-ramp, right? So for a certain kind of generational moment, right, this on-ramp into this particular form. So surely beyond the question of whether or not it is in and of itself as a product, good, bad, right, wrong, mm-hmm. How do you think people will feel about it? And maybe in different categories, maybe folks who come knowing something and those who don't.
Yeah, I try to think this way when I was approaching the screeners, humble brag, just from a perspective of what if I had never seen the anime? Am I getting, just a great story? Am I getting a great performance out of these actors? It's it is really hard to erase your memory of the anime. And I think the show, if you have never watched any anime at all, you might be able to appreciate this show. I do think that this show has been structured in a way to fit Hollywood storytelling, as I was saying before. And I'm not the first to observe this by any means, but it's kind of like the difference between watching a Miyazaki film and a Pixar film. You know, one will, in its storytelling structure, prioritize this idea of space and gradual change and interiority in its characters. Pixar, on the other hand, is very conflict-driven, and it's a subtle structure that makes all the difference. So if you have seen anime, maybe you'll watch this version and you'll feel like there's something uncanny about it. As far as the comparisons go. But if you had never watched any anime and you just watched the Netflix version, you might not have that uncanny feeling. You might feel like, oh, this is a fun story. This is basically a space Western rather than the space opera that you get from the anime.
I want to talk about the music. I want to talk about the sonic aspects, Jeff. When you brought up the point of jazz and the important ways that that the sonic, because we've been talking a little bit about the visual and even the way that plot and story are kind of driven or, sort of represented. But talk to me about what it sounds like.
One of the things to really note, and this is true actually of the live action as well, in the sense that they did bring back the original composer, Yoko Kanno, to do the score for the new score, actually, kind of a brand new sonic landscape for the Netflix series. But Yoko Kanno created the soundtrack and the, again, indelible audio space for the original animated series. And what's really interesting, if you know a little bit about how the show was created, in many cases, she looked at early sketches, looked at early breakdowns, created music, and then after seeing later stages of the animation, actually created new music, which then Watanabe, the director, essentially altered the scenes themselves to reshape around her, altered again soundscapes. And so as a result, it really was kind of like a jazz process, riffing off each other in a way that I don't think is very common in animation, where any changes are expensive, and especially changes that are reflecting what might seem as whim. But the music is so incredible. From the very beginning, that sort of completely unforgettable music that accompanies the opening credits. Cowboy Bebop has music in its name and music in its soul. And even the style of storytelling very much feels like it's designed to reflect its musical forebear, if you will. It definitely has a sense of almost being improvisational in parts. It definitely has a feeling of allowing each of its characters to almost serve like instruments, kind of stepping forward, then stepping back into the chorus. Really hard to describe it without having actually watched all 26 episodes, to people who haven't watched all 26 episodes. But over the course of that one season, you really do feel like you've consumed like an album.
Shirley, just on a last question here, what could this mean? What might this Netflix series mean for Hollywood and anime? And do we want Hollywood to be doing a lot of particularly live action anime?
Oh boy, I'm actually kind of torn on this. As Jeff was saying earlier, I also feel this way, where it's kind of like, if we want to take influences from, global products, oh God, that sounds so corporate. I think you know what I mean. And riff on them. I think that's the beauty of art, right? And I do think this adaptation probably comes the closest among the graveyard of Hollywood live action adaptations to capture the spirit of the original. Like, the showrunners, the creatives, the team clearly respects the original anime, but they are also inviting these comparisons that we've been going through because they lean so heavily on what fans remember of the anime. So how do I feel about the future? I'm still wary of any announcement such as the one about the live action adaptation of Your Name that's in the works, that's stalled. You know, this is not Japanese anime, but Netflix's ongoing production of the live action version of Avatar: The Last Airbender makes me kind of wary, even if the casting is really great. It's just a medium that is so, so risky to translate when it comes to Hollywood storytelling. I think Hollywood really likes to package whatever story that they found and to make it just purely action-driven, black and white, good versus bad, you know? And that's why Netflix's Death Note didn't work. That's why the 2017 Ghost in the Shell didn't work, for among many other reasons.
Many other reasons.
You know, that's why Dragon Ball Evolution was a travesty. You know, I just think the problem that we've seen when it comes to turning anime into a Hollywood live action product remains the same. Hollywood consistently tries to reshape the storytelling structure. And I think if there's a way to move beyond that, I think maybe we could really see some riffing that is inspired instead of rote.
Shirley Lee is a staff writer covering culture for The Atlantic. And Jeff Yang is a cultural critic and co-author of the forthcoming book, Rise, A Pop History of Asian America from the 90s to Now. See you both soon, Space Cowboys.
See you, Melissa.
See ya.
All right, folks, that's all we have for you today. Now, we want to send our condolences to all the families of those killed in a senseless act of violence in Waukesha, Wisconsin over the weekend. We know the whole town is reeling after the driver of an SUV plowed into the crowd celebrating their annual holiday parade, and the takeaway is sending all of Waukesha our deepest sympathies. On a bit of good news, we're celebrating along with the families of the two U.S. missionaries released in Haiti. They're among the 17 members of a missionary group who were kidnapped over a month ago, and we continue to hold the remaining 15 missionaries, their families and communities in our hearts as we hope for safe return to their loved ones this holiday season. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. We'll be back tomorrow.